This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. The Affordable Care Act, known to many as Obamacare, promised access to health care to millions more Americans. One problem, what if there aren't enough primary care doctors to take care of the millions of new patients? And what if the amount the doctors are being paid to see those patients just isn't worth it? We hear about a crisis in primary care, and that's what New England Public Radio reporter Karen Brown wanted to learn more about. She spent a full year exploring the path to primary care, following doctors in training to see what's turning many away from the profession into higher-paying specialties or other work despite the high demand for primary care services. Coming up, Karen will join us, along with primary care advocates and educators, to weigh in on some of the latest trends and to tell us what the future of primary care looks like, both here in the Northeast and across America. If you are a current or former primary care provider, or you're considering becoming one, we want you to weigh in, too. Comment on our website, WNPR.org. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter, at Where We Live. We're going to start, though, with Karen's documentary. It's called The Path to Primary Care: Who Will Be the Next Generation of Frontline Doctors? It was funded by a fellowship from the Association of Healthcare Journalists and the Commonwealth Fund. This is Where We Live.
The High Street Health Center sits upon a hill in one of Springfield's poorest neighborhoods. The hallways and waiting room are filled with coughing or sniffling patients, many speaking Spanish, some on crutches, some without any obvious ailments. Behind two more locked doors in the staff office, one 29-year-old doctor, a second-year resident, is having a particularly bad summer morning. She's on the phone waiting for emergency services to pick up.
Hi, Joyce. This is Dr. Jobbins calling over from High Street Health Center. I have a patient over here who's actively homicidal and suicidal, who I'm going to be sending to the ER. Do I Section 12 her now?
Dr. Katie Jobbins has known this patient for more than a year. The woman struggled with chronic psychiatric issues and was doing better for a while. Jobbins updates her nurse on this latest visit.
This is the worst I've ever seen her. I mean, she's been like a little like off occasionally, you know, when she doesn't take her meds right or things like that, but I'm afraid she's going to hurt herself.
Jobbins has never had to commit a patient to the hospital for a mental health crisis. She has to feel her way through the paperwork.
If she's homeless, do I just write homeless?
Yes.
A few cubicles over, Dr. Danielle Sliwa, a 32-year-old resident, sits at her computer waiting for her patients to arrive.
I'm just going to log into my medical record.
There's a 30% no-show rate here, so the clinic tends to intentionally overbook.
If everyone comes, it can be very, very busy, a little bit overwhelming, a little bit stressful. But then sometimes you have days where half your panel doesn't show up.
And on an evening shift one town over, Dr. Sarah Tischer examines a 30-year-old named Kevin.
Deep breath.
Kevin is uninsured. He came to this free clinic in East Longmeadow, where Tischer volunteers as part of her residency, because his cough won't go away.
Everything from chest up just felt like it was shutting down.
Awesome. That sounds great. That sounds exactly like how I've been feeling. So when did all that start?
Unlike many of Tischer's cases, okay, Kevin's is pretty straightforward. She recommends ibuprofen for inflammation.
But mostly rest and fluids. Unfortunately, the things that we all know about.
That we never can get.
Exactly. That we have the hardest time getting. All right, I will be back, Kevin.
Okay. Thank you.
These young doctors are in the middle of their residency at Bay State Medical Center in Springfield, a hospital affiliated with Tufts University. They've completed 4 years of medical school, so they're already MDs, and are now in the hands-on part of their training. Most residents at Bay State are in internal medicine, a broad term that covers specialties like cardiology, gastroenterology, or dermatology. But Tischer, Sliwa, and Jobbins are part of a specialized track, one designed to create more primary care doctors. Michael Rosenblum is a residency director.
If you get people before medical school, and even at the beginning of medical school, there's a huge interest in primary care. The vast majority of medical students want to establish relationships and know people over long periods of time, and then we see that kind of peter off.
In part, he says, because of their training. In traditional residencies, students spend most of their time inside the hospital. But Bay State's primary care track is steeped in the clinic experience. It was launched in 2011 with funding from the Affordable Care Act. After all, as more people get insurance, they need frontline doctors to act as gatekeepers to the medical system.
When we look at really highly functional systems, you need to have a really strong core of primary care doctors to be the base. of this pyramid. And we as a country don't have that, and I think we struggle with that.
Workforce surveys consistently show that primary care is in trouble. Too many doctors are leaving the field, and too few are in the pipeline to enter. Already, the government counts a shortfall of 8,000 primary care doctors. Another estimate says by 2020, the shortage will grow to 45,000. Michael Rosenblum.
So really our goal from the get-go has been to turn people on to primary care and to, you know, turn the ship in the other direction. It takes a long time to turn a ship, though.
Last year, when I started following this group of new doctors, 12 were in various stages of Bay State's primary care residency. That's compared to 54 in the general internal medicine program. This is not surprising. An NYU study found that the number of students choosing to train in primary care declined by 50% between 1999 and 2008. Most choose to go into specialties. So who will be left on the medical front lines for the next generation? And can new programs like Bay State's fill out the ranks? The hope is that giving new doctors a taste of primary care medicine will whet their appetites for the profession. But as these residents will show us, there are no guarantees.
What room is she in? Did they move her?
A few minutes after Katie Jobbins sends her suicidal patient to the emergency room, a nurse tells her the next patient has arrived.
Yeah, I have two patients already in rooms.
Jobbins asks if another doctor can take the appointment, but then remembers...
Well, the only problem is the person that it is only wants to see me. That's why I think she was booked with me.
Jobbins wants her patients to see her as their personal liaison with the healthcare system. It's just today is a bit nuts.
We're taught how to deal with the basics, but there are days where you're going to be very frustrated and overwhelmed with something very complicated.
So she gathers herself and goes into the exam room, coming out a few minutes later to talk to the nurse again.
I think it's pain today. I mean, she's like crying in the room. She's in so much pain.
Katie Jobbins has wanted to be a doctor since she was an athletic, accident-prone teenager in Hamden, Massachusetts. She had a close relationship with her own pediatrician, a kind man, she recalls, who wore a toy koala bear on his stethoscope.
I broke all my fingers once when I was in middle school, running onto the tennis court with a racket in one hand and a bottle of water in the other. And he just looked at me and kind of shook his head and laughed and said, okay, what'd you do now?
Her closest friends studied the humanities. Jobbins stuck with math and science. After 4 years of med school, she started training as a surgeon.
It made sense to me. You know, you have a problem, you fix it, you take it out.
But after 2 years of mostly gallbladder removal and blood vessel surgeries, Jobbins noticed something about herself. While the other surgeons tried to spend as much time as possible in the operating room...
I was the one who was always talking longer to patients, or I was having family meetings.
Finally, it hit her. She wanted to be their point person, their care coordinator, their primary care doctor.
I like establishing relationships with people and getting to know them outside of what their medical diagnoses are. And I like to laugh a lot, too, so I try to make my patient's experience not something that's a dreadful one when they come to the doctor.
Hey!
On a clinic shift in late summer, resident Sarah Tischer does her best to put a five-year-old and his worried mother at ease.
Can you believe how many people came to see your rash?
The boy good-naturedly pulls down his pants and shows a patch of raised red bumps on his behind.
He hasn't had any other new medications lately.
He doesn't take any medications at all.
This has actually been there.
After a few minutes, Tischer's team decides this actually goes beyond primary care. They refer the family to a dermatologist.
You stumped us.
At 38, Sarah Tischer is older than most of her fellow residents. She grew up in Iowa, intrigued by the ocean and thinking she'd become a marine biologist. She got work in research after college, but something was missing.
I was often sitting in a lab by myself. I wanted to do something that had more social aspects involved as well.
She entered med school, where she considered going into neurology or psychiatry, but she always felt pulled towards primary care.
A lot of the physicians that I worked with that were doing primary care loved what they did, and they were really passionate about it.
But there weren't a lot of primary care residencies in 2011, so she applied for general residency at Bay State. So happens the directors were just getting their new program off the ground.
And in the middle of my interview, they said, oh, you're interested in primary care? Hey, do we have a deal for you?
Most doctors I've met going into primary care talk about their sense of social justice. They want to work for underserved communities or to fill a critical need. It's rare to hear people list the superficial trappings of the job as a driving factor. And that's not surprising, Tischer says, given what they hear about the field.
In medical school, the biggest thing that comes up is money.
A survey by the Medical Group Management Association last year found the average salary for a primary care doctor is about $190,000. That may sound like a lot, but consider that some have debt near $250,000. Meanwhile, they see their colleagues in cardiology or hematology, after a couple more years of training, making at least twice that amount, sometimes up to $500,000 or $600,000.
I tried to remind myself I didn't go into this for the money to begin with, but I think that there are other people that maybe could be swayed into doing primary care, but they're swayed away from primary care because of the challenges for paying back your loans.
The Affordable Care Act included new loan forgiveness programs for primary care doctors, and it temporarily expanded the National Health Service, which subsidizes debt in exchange for working in underserved areas. But in the minds of many doctors, that doesn't erase what feels like a gross inequity, one largely caused by a healthcare system that rewards procedures over conversations and a pay scale that's determined by a panel made up almost entirely of specialists. But perhaps even more discouraging is what the money disparity says about the status and prestige of primary care. Gina Luciano co-directs Bay State's primary care residency.
Here are these type A competitive people that have been at the top of their class, like since kindergarten, you know, and, you know, they try to get into the most prestigious colleges, and you know, it's always very competitive.
So when they get into residency, she says, they want to stay on the up escalator.
And you have all of these mentors that are telling you, you could do cardiology, you could do critical care. It feels really good that here are these really sort of prestigious things to go into in medicine. It's hard, I think, to be swayed from that.
This is what Dr. Andrew Morris Singer, who runs the advocacy group Primary Care Progress, calls the hidden curriculum of medical education, and not always hidden very well.
There's also explicit statements like, you're too smart to be a primary care doctor, this is a dead field, or my favorite, a monkey could practice primary care, why would you do that? So it's kind of a whole range of things, but the basic admonition is, hey, it's a waste of a medical education.
So he came today concerned for STDs.
Danielle Sliwa is treating the patient who hasn't seen a doctor in years. He showed up with a host of problems, not all of them medical.
He was absent from the clinic for a year and a half because he was incarcerated for breaking and entering.
She's in the back room with her advisor, trying to figure out what the man needs.
Gonorrhea, what is that, metronidazole?
No, look it up. You will forget it.
I think the attractive thing about this environment is that the patients are really interesting, and I'm really terrified of being bored. I like always being challenged.
As a young child in Belchertown, Massachusetts, Sliwa was scared of her pediatrician, but gradually grew intrigued by what he did. By the time she finished college as an anthropology major, she knew she wanted to become a physician.
I sort of imagined myself as this small-town doctor where I took care of horses or something in my spare time because my practice was right in my house and people came to me and I made house calls.
Working at the High Street Clinic is not like that. She enjoys the relationships with patients, but says it can be hard to work with a highly stressed, low-income population.
If they're engaged and involved, I think it can be very rewarding. But sometimes when people access care intermittently and perhaps aren't always compliant with going to the lab or picking up their medications or taking them regularly, then it can become very discouraging. You kind of wonder why you're putting so much of your own energy into it, I guess.
By this time, Sliwa was in her second year as a primary care resident. She'd recently spent a month working at a clinic in the Himalayas, which she said opened her eyes to the diversity in the human experience and in healthcare. She was especially impressed at how rural clinics were able to fashion together screenings for cervical cancer using a vinegar-like acid. When she returned to Springfield, she came to a big decision. Primary care is not for her. She wants to go into oncology.
When I am interacting with cancer patients, when I'm treating cancer patients, there's just something inside of me that's different than when I'm treating other types of patients, that it combines, you know, spirituality, it combines religion, science, long-term partnerships.
Sliwa's colleagues in the primary care program say they were not entirely surprised by her decision, but that hasn't stopped them from giving her a hard time.
Anytime she says something that we think is very primary care-ish, we'll say, really? Are you really going to go into oncology?
They do tease me quite a bit, actually. Sometimes they call me a traitor to the primary care program. I do get a little bit sensitive sometimes, and then they'll sit me down and be like, you know that we are just kidding with you. So,
in my mind, she's still doing primary care, but with a more oncologic twist to it.
Again, residency director Gina Luciano.
So I don't feel like I've lost her at all. I just feel like she's doing something very creative with what we've given her over a couple of years.
Do you give her a hard time anyway, just for good measure?
Oh, of course. Of course.
Medical practices have gotten creative, filling the primary care gap, relying more on nurse practitioners and physician assistants. But healthcare leaders say it's still important to get the more highly trained doctors into the pipeline. The problem is the typical structure of medical education seems to work against the primary care pitch.
After you. You can keep eating, though. That's okay.
A group of residents walks through the hallways of Bay State Medical Center for their daily rounds.
Continues to have the pain in her hips.
So her diabetes is still uncontrolled. Yesterday it was at 4.
This is the way most internal medicine residents are trained, on the hospital wards, with specialists roaming in and out to challenge them on medical questions and pinpoint some of the more unusual cases.
Also, there's a small pocket of abscess.
Oh.
So we should talk to radiology and see which is the best way.
Residents say they become most confident on the inpatient wards, where they get to know specialists better than anyone else. That's a problem if you're trying to groom them for primary care, says Dr. Sudeep Olick, another Bay State residency director.
We're preparing them well and giving them skills to do one thing and then thinking that they're going to be comfortable doing something very different.
Olick says Bay State's new program is trying to upend this model, as are a number of new primary care tracks across the country. The Affordable Care Act funded about 500 new primary care residency slots a year and launched 60 primary care programs at community health centers.
Now serving E847 at station number 1.
And in 2011, the federal government gave 5 different Veterans Administration health centers $1 million a year for 5 years to set up new primary care residencies. But even in this new VA program, designed to win over primary care doctors, residents are still choosing specialties. Some of them say it's because of the time they spend in the clinic.
The interactions are constant and draining in primary care for me.
David Levitt intended to go into primary care when he started residency, but after 3 years, he's changed his mind. He finds the teamwork better at the hospital than the outpatient clinic.
It could be that in clinic, I'm usually seeing patients back to back to back, writing notes back to back to back, have a lunch break, and then I do it again in the afternoon. Whereas in the hospital, there's more of an ebb and flow to the work where you do a bunch of work up front and then maybe it lulls.
Levitt is planning to become a hospitalist, the person who oversees basic care in a hospital. His salary will be similar to a primary care doctor, but he will have set hours, and at the end of each shift, he'll hand over patient responsibility to the next person.
I have a candy problem. They can tell how my day is going by how many times I've gone in to get candy.
Katie Jobbins is in a good mood as she looks up her roster of patients. She's invited me to hang out on her shift on this fall morning. Her first patient is a no-show. The second is one of her favorites.
Okay. So Rosa, how are you doing?
¿Cómo estás haciendo? Bien.
Rosa is 59. She's recovering from surgery and just back from vacation. They speak through an interpreter as Dr. Jobbins looks Rosa directly in the eyes.
How have you been feeling? Any chest pain at all?
Sí, lo tengo, pero un poco menos.
Rosa tells me that Jobbins has been a lifesaver over the past year, a year that included a severe bout of depression.
Como una consejera. La cogí.
She's like a counselor to her. And she don't like taking a lot of medications.
So she just comes and talks to me?
When Jobin stands up at the end of the visit, Rosa gives her a hug and a pleading look. Since there's often turnover among the residents, Rosa is worried she'll lose Dr. Jobbins.
You're not leaving.
No.
No.
Estoy acostumbrada a ella.
Yeah, she's just used to you.
I know, I'm she used to you too.
But Rosa doesn't yet know what Jobbins had told me earlier that day.
All right, so in the last few months that I haven't seen you, are you still going into primary care?
I actually decided I'm going to go into cardiology.
She knows this comes as a surprise. She says the decision didn't come down to the reasons most people cite for avoiding primary care, salary, workload, and prestige. She just really likes working with the heart.
It was a big struggle. You know, I really do love doing primary care, and I think I'm going to miss a big part of that. And I know that there is a huge need for good primary care doctors out there, but I wanted something a little bit more than that, too.
Like doing intensive care and spending more time in the hospital. Ironically, as a cardiologist, she's still likely to take on many of the primary care duties of her patients because there won't be enough primary care doctors. Jobin says Bay State's program did all it could to groom her in primary care. It prepared her for both the chaos and the rewards of outpatient medicine. So she was nervous telling her advisors that after 3 years on a primary care track, she'd be getting off.
Because I was afraid, and you're like, again, this, you don't want to let people down feeling, and they all were very happy for me and thought it was a good fit.
She'll stay on for one more year as a chief resident and then compete for a fellowship in cardiology. She can't be sure she'll get in.
I would happily be a primary care doctor if cardiology didn't work out for me.
If a doctor like Katie Jobbins, who's so committed to patient relationships and preventive care, can't be convinced to stay in primary care, how does that bode for the field in general? It means advocates for primary care have their work cut out for them. Bay State promoted its primary care residency at conferences and medical schools. After a round of interviews, they offered slots to 4 people. Only one chose to come. Director Gina Luciano.
It was definitely very disappointing. I mean, I think we would have loved to have filled our class. It's just really hard to recruit residents to primary care.
The Affordable Care Act did include new financial incentives for primary care doctors, including higher Medicare and Medicaid reimbursement and extra support for what's called the medical home model. But that money expires this year, and few expect Congress to renew it. The ACA also created a commission to analyze the physician workforce, but that commission never met and was never funded by Congress. Meanwhile, Bay State has sent into the world one graduate of its primary care residency, Sarah Tischer. So, yeah, can just tell me how things are going. You've been there, what, a month now? A little bit more?
Yeah, it's been a little over a month. Yeah,
I called Tischer shortly after she started her new job at a private group practice in northeastern Connecticut.
So things are going well. They're being very kind to me. They're sort of ramping me up slowly.
She chose this job out of 3 offers she got out of residency. She is the newest doctor in the practice and the youngest by 20 years. Before she even started, patients were calling the office to get an appointment.
Of course, in a small community like this, when people find out that a new physician is coming to town, word travels like wildfire. But I was really shocked. I didn't realize how busy I was going to be.
Since most of her patients have been waiting a long time for a doctor, their problems tend to be complex, chronic diseases and conditions that have long been ignored. It's daunting, she admits, but she says her new colleagues are doing their best to protect her from early burnout.
You know, they'll say things like, hey, isn't it your afternoon off? What are you still doing here? Go home.
Tischer's aware that people are watching to see if she sticks it out in the field. Unlike a friend of hers from medical school, who got through 1 year of primary care in the real world before throwing up her hands and taking a fellowship in infectious disease. So how are you not going to be that person in a year?
Good question. I think that you have to remember that the grass is always greener. You know, there are problems in every specialty. I'm definitely in it for the long haul.
That was The Path to Primary Care. Who will be the next generation of frontline doctors? It's a new documentary by Karen Brown of New England Public Radio. When we come back, Karen will join us in studio, along with some doctors who will weigh in on the state of primary care in America. And we want you to join the conversation. Comment on our website, also WNPR.org, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about primary care. It's been a big push, including with some federal money, to increase the number of doctors practicing as primary care physicians. But will it be enough to meet the booming demand? Before the break, we listened to a new public radio documentary called The Path to Primary Care: Who Will Be the Next Generation of Frontline Doctors? Joining us by phone is the producer of that documentary, Karen Brown. She's a reporter with New England Public Radio. Karen, thanks so much for joining us.
I'm happy to. Thanks, John.
And joining us in studio is Andy Selinger. He's the chair of family medicine at Quinnipiac University's Frank Netter School of Medicine. And welcome to the program, doctor. Thanks so much for coming in.
I'm happy to be here.
Andy, I'd like to get your reactions first to Karen Brown's documentary. As we were listening in, what we heard was a story of doctors who are thinking about getting into primary care. Some are pushed away for financial reasons. Some decide to go into other fields. What do you see as you look at the landscape of primary care right now in our region?
I see a very bright future. I practice in private practice with ProHealth physicians, and the landscape of delivering health care to our population has changed dramatically over the past 5 to 6 years. Just to give you some numbers, there's 120,000 or more actively practicing family physicians, which you can think of as a proxy for primary care. There are over 400 residencies, and we are very thrilled to say that the number of residency slots has been increasing for the past 5 years, and we have been meeting those number of slots by interested applicants, and the fill rate has remained at a very high 96%. This applies to both allopathic and osteopathic medical schools. Nationally, there is a campaign going on called Family Medicine for America's Health, which is a multi-million-dollar campaign to encourage students to learn more about the specialty, why it's so important in primary care. And when you'd like, I can talk about some specifics that we're doing at our own School of Medicine to bring home the message, to illuminate the joys of practicing primary care medicine.
And we would like to talk about the Quinnipiac program more in depth in just a moment, but give us some specifics about why the last 5 or 6 years you've seen this increase. You say that things have changed quite a bit since 2008 or so. What's been behind that change?
I think behind the change is the shifting landscape, the recognition in our country that too many dollars are being spent on unnecessary health care, and that we're all trying to achieve the triple aim, which is better quality, better access, and control of cost. And this is now filtered down through all the people that pay for health insurance, from individual patients to employers, health insurers, and most significantly, the federal government. Let me give you one quick bite of fact,
sure,
which is in 2016, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, which cover all Medicare patients, are determined that 30% of their expenditures will be based on the value and the outcome of the health care and not the volume of the services delivered. And by 2018, they want 50% of their outlay to be determined by the value and the outcome of health care and not the volume of services delivered.
I'm wondering if you feel like the problem that was laid out in Karen's documentary is a regional issue. If indeed we look at Western Massachusetts versus Connecticut versus the entire Northeast versus the United States, whether or not we're going to see very different patterns around this.
Healthcare is completely and entirely regional. In fact, some of the schools that graduate the highest percentage of students choosing family medicine are the University of North Dakota, Kansas, Oregon Health Sciences Center, Missouri, East Carolina. So you can see these are more rural. And these are public institutions rather than private. Student debt burden, unfortunately, drives career choice, rightly or wrongly. And And so there are very significant regional differences around cost of living and student choice and the people with whom they train.
Kara is calling from Glastonbury. Hi there, Kara. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. What's up?
I am a registered dietitian and a certified diabetes educator in Glastonbury, Connecticut. I have a private practice, which is housed in one of the family care doctors here in Glastonbury. But I feel that there is a real crisis in coordinated care. You know, what the doctor was talking about with outcomes is very true. We have to improve outcomes. But what I'm finding is that providers are not referring patients for lifestyle education. And in particular, if I can cite a little fact, in my January 2015 clinical endocrinology news, the CDC documented that only 6.8% of people with diabetes, type 2, because type 2 diabetes accounts for 95% of the diabetes out there, which is epidemic proportions, only 6.8% of them were referred and participated in self-management. And that's according to the CDC.
So you're talking about a crisis in coordinated care.
Absolutely, because
let me just get Karen Brown to just comment on that quickly. And Kara, thank you very much for your phone call. Karen?
I mean, you know, primary care is coordinating care, and from what I hear, that I mean, she's absolutely right that there seems to be a crisis really in getting people who want to take on what is essentially a very difficult job of, you know, the healthcare system is so complex, and what I was hearing from a lot of the residents that I talked to is that it was such a relief to only have one topic you had to be an expert on. You know, people would go from primary care where they had to take care of mental health issues and housing issues and things that had nothing to do with medicine at all. But once they did their rotation in cardiology or dermatology, they just had to know about the heart or they just had to know about the skin. And that was a real relief for them. And I can understand that on a, you know, on a personal level. But the truth is you really need the gatekeepers, and that seems to be where the challenge is, finding those.
Andy, I'm wondering if you can comment on that, this idea that, you know, when doctors rotate through and they see a specialty, they say, well, this is a lot different than having to deal with a wide panoply of ailments and other issues that a primary care doctor has to face.
Yes, I can comment on that. Plus, I think the term gatekeeper has gone by the wayside now. And we prefer not to use that term. We prefer to think of ourselves in primary care as coordinators of care and working in a team-based model. There is a new term called the patient-centered medical home, and all primary care practices are being incentivized, both financially and otherwise, to achieve that status, and then not just to achieve it in name, but to achieve it in practice. As far as too much to know, I hear it at both ends of the spectrum. Absolutely, primary care medicine is not for everybody. Either there is an overwhelming sense that there's too much to know and people are not at a comfort level with that, but there's also a concern by some students that there's too little to do, that you'll do well exams, you'll take care of colds and sore throats. So we hear it at both ends of the spectrum. At Quinnipiac Medical School, we are focused on getting our students out into the community in the first 3 months of their beginning medical education, a half day a week with a primary care physician. And also, we are focused on teaching them the important interpersonal skills of being a family physician, the need to listen to your patient, communicate, and relate to your patient.
And we heard this in Karen's documentary, and I guess I'm wondering, this is something we've talked about on the show before, and it's a fascinating topic to me. Some of those skills are very, very teachable, and some of those skills are less teachable. There are certain people who want to end up talking for a living on the radio and others who just could never imagine doing that. Can you teach some of those interpersonal skills to people who maybe feel a little bit more comfortable in a surgeon's role, being maybe a little bit more removed from that day-to-day interaction?
Nothing's black and white. Yes, you can teach the importance of motivational interviewing, the importance of making sure the patient heard what you shared with them, but not everybody's cut out to be a primary care physician. Some people, just by virtue of their comfort level, want a narrow band of knowledge and to be the absolute expert in commanding that knowledge, and prefer to do specialties in medicine that may not be as highly interpersonal as the need to translate what's happening in the world of healthcare to a patient.
I want to get to one more quick phone call before our next break. Andrew is calling from Bethlehem. Hello, Andrew. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Well, I'm a primary care doctor, and I've wanted to be since I was about 6 years old, as my grandfather was. And I've been as a primary care physician for 40 years in a relatively rural area out here in northwest Connecticut. I'm also an associate professor of medicine at Yale University, teaching in the primary care program. And I did that for over 20 years, so with the Yale and Waterbury Hospital affiliate. So I have a, you know, some, I rarely call the radio, but I have a very strong feelings about this. It comes down to those two reasons, which everybody's been talking about. Number one is the financial reimbursement, probably three reasons. The other reason is the intellectual challenge, and the third reason is the interpersonal connections that you get when you do primary care. The reimbursements are ridiculous for primary care, and that's why when I was teaching residents, only 2 out of 5 in our residency program from Yale actually ended up going into primary care because of income expectations, loans that they had to pay off, and the like. The other reasons were because it is a tremendous amount to learn, and I often use the analogy, if you're an auto mechanic and your job is to take care of a carburetor on the same model, and that's all you ever do, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to do that. But if you have to do the entire engine, multiple problems within the engine on multiple models, and you have to know everything there is about that engine, which is the most valuable, intellectual, and hopefully reimbursable skill? I think the guy that works on the entire car knows everything about it or tries to, as opposed to somebody who works on just the engine. Admittedly, it's a lot easier to work on, just the carburetor. It's a lot easier to work on a carburetor, but which is more complex and which should be reimbursed and more respected? Not that everybody should be respected, but...
Of course, and I want to put... And Andrew, thank you very much for sharing that story because I think it's an important one, especially given all the experience that you have. I want to bring in before our break here our next guest, Andrew Morris Singer, who's president and principal founder of Primary Care Progress, to maybe address that question. And Andrew, thank you so much for joining us. You heard the other Andrew on the line, a longtime primary care physician. He's talking about the financial reimbursement being one of the biggest challenges. Do you see it that way too?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me. It's a huge challenge right now. When a student chooses to go into primary care, he or she is basically walking away from $3.5 million of lifetime revenue. And when that student has on average somewhere between $160,000 and $200,000 worth of debt, that's a significant disincentive to going into primary care. But it's not the only reason we're seeing a dearth of interest in primary care careers right now.
It's not the only reason. We'll get to some of those other reasons right after our break. Karen Brown, quickly, I'd just like to maybe have you flesh out a little bit more this particular problem for the doctors that you talk to. It is a big one. The fact is you're facing these hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of debts. It seems like a pretty easy calculation if you just look at it economically.
Yeah, and honestly, you know, everyone I talked to when I asked that point blank said, look, we didn't go into medicine for the money. And they were possibly a little, you know, a little uncomfortable with admitting that. But they did admit that, you know, loan repayment is a big one. And more to the point, it's what that says about the prestige of the field. It's what that says about how society values primary care doctors. And that seemed to be an even bigger disincentive than the actual money was. If you're paying 3 times as much for a specialist than you are for primary care, then society must not value what I do as much.
We're talking with Karen Brown, who's a reporter for New England Public Radio, whose documentary, The Path to Primary Care, Who Will Be the Next Generation of Frontline Doctors, got us thinking about this issue. We're also joined in studio by Andy Selinger, who's the chair of family medicine at Quinnipiac University's new School of Medicine. We have on the line Andrew Morris Singer, who's president and principal founder of Primary Care Progress. We'll take some more of your tweets and emails. Your emails, where we live at WNPR.org, tweets at where we live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, Stanley Maxwell is a jazz meets funk band that brought their music live to our studios for a concert and a conversation. We'll listen back, and we'll also tell the unlikely story of how another listener heard them on our show and helped to make a connection with the real Stanley Maxwell. Intrigued? Find out more coming up on Tomorrow's Where We Live. Today we're talking about primary care. Some suggest that there's a crisis in primary care in America. Others say not so fast. There's a lot more people trying to get into this field. There's a new school specifically aimed at primary care doctors at Quinnipiac University, and Andy Selinger is here from Quinnipiac. Karen Brown joins us on the phone. She's a reporter for New England Public Radio who's been covering this story for us, and she had a documentary that we played earlier in this hour to get us started. And Andrew Morris Singer is with us on the phone, president and principal founder of Primary Care Progress. So, Andrew Morris Singer, let me go to you next. You talked about a few of the reasons why you feel people are being dissuaded from going into primary care. We talked about the economic incentive. You might want to get into a specialty because you're going to leave a lot of money on the table if you don't get into a specialty. What are the other things that you think are keeping people out of primary care that you'd like to solve?
So, you know, there's a combination of things, unfortunately. So, obviously, there's the financial disincentives we've talked about. There's also significant academic discouragement. Your average medical school student is admonished that going into primary care is basically a waste of a medical education. I think the other major thing is that you've got a real lack of a compelling vision for what future primary care professional careers could look like. Your average medical student rotates through academic practices that are pretty antiquated and dysfunctional. They're totally under-resourced, yet taking care of some of the most sick and complicated patients. And so medical students walk into those practices and say to themselves, why does it feel like this practice was actually designed to destroy an interest in a primary care career? So you take that whole mishmash, that big combination, and it's not a surprise why, you know, less than 20% of medical students are choosing primary care careers, whereas, you know, years ago it used to be 50%.
But what we're hearing from Andy Selinger at Quinnipiac University is in the last few years, certainly with the advent of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, there's more and more focus on health outcomes, less and less focus on fee-for-service. The idea is, Andrew, that over the course of the next few years, there is going to be a revolution in the way primary care doctors are, you know, taught, the way that they actually practice. Do you think that that's happening at a rate that will start to help us see some change over the near term?
Yes and no. Yes and no. I think the fact of the matter is there are incredibly promising things happening to advance primary care. There's significant investment, but the academic world lags behind what's happening in private practice in the community. And in your average medical school in this country, your average medical student is still spending time in practices that seem like they were designed to destroy an interest in a primary care career.
I'm wondering, do you have a thought on that, Andy?
I do, and he is correct about academic institutions. I would like to think, with some exceptions, we are an institution where our students go out into the community. They will see embedded care coordinators in practices such as in my own. They will see outreach programs, health educators, accountable care organizations where money is on the table that you can share in savings if you generate them, concrete attempts to avoid readmissions to hospitals and inappropriate ER utilization. But he's correct that this is in the community. This is not in the academic world. That's why primary care clinical education, as we are doing, must take place in the community setting where the paradigm shifts are occurring.
I want to get to David, who's calling from West Hartford. Hi, David.
One of my daughters is just finishing UConn Medical School in her fourth year. Unfortunately, we're going to lose her to Oregon for residency. She's out there interviewing. But I must say, UConn really encouraged her to be in primary care. So UConn may be an exception to what your guests were just talking about. But, you know, the worry I have is that though I think she's totally committed to this and has done some extra work with Mary Herrera, who's a great integrative medicine doc at UConn, she's going to have about $300,000 in debt when she finishes. And, you know, the pressure that drives med students away from primary care is partly right there, and, you know, probably some other reasons you've been discussing as well.
My goodness, that's an awful lot of money.
A lot of money for modest pay relative to what doctors make.
Well, David, thank you very much. I want to hear from Emily in North Haven next. Hi, Emily. Go ahead.
Hi, yeah. So I'm an assistant professor at Quinnipiac in the Masters of Social Work program, and I actually have some of the med students in my classes. And one of the things that we're really trying to push is an integrated care model. And, you know, some of the things they were talking about in terms of the burden of mental health issues and housing issues and coordinated care, I think could be so well positioned if we could integrate master-level social workers into primary care models, which I know some places are doing. And I think Quinnipiac is really kind of unique in that way, that we're really trying to focus on an interprofessional education context so that we can prepare those folks to go out and see the benefit, the mutual benefit of working together.
Hey, Emily, thank you so much for the phone call. Neil's calling from Vernon. Hello, Neil.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, my name is Neil Brooks. I'm a family physician in Vernon, Connecticut, and I'm a past president of the American Academy of Family Physicians. And interestingly, I have the opportunity of now working under Dr. Selinger at Quinnipiac. There's vast numbers of reasons for the young graduates from medical school not picking primary care. One is that I didn't hear it discussed, but there's at times an absolute movement by some of the people who are in subspecialties to discourage it. They'll say you're too good to be in primary care.
This idea, and it's something we've heard a little bit, Neil, so far in the program, but it is an interesting thing. And Andrew Morris Singer, this idea that you're too good to be in primary care, it sounds amazing given the amount that primary care physicians are expected to do and the amount that we rely on them in society today, but it's something that happens, right?
Well, you know, here's the deal. If you go out and you go to some of the innovative practices that Andy's been discussing and some of your callers have been talking about, you will see primary care providers doing incredible things. You will see them acting as comprehensivists. You will see them addressing acute issues, chronic disease, coordinating care, addressing the social determinants of health. And I think the problem is that in a lot of academic settings, people have just seen a very particular slice of primary care that's actually not consistent with the very special places that primary care is going. So I think one of the solutions is we need more schools like Quinnipiac University. We need more students getting exposed to these innovative models, not only so they can be hopeful about their future, but so they can start learning the skills of team-based care, coordination of care, right, integration of behavioral health and mental health into their overall care plan.
Karen Brown, a last thing for you quickly. This whole idea of patient-centered medicine is something we hear an awful lot about, but it also means that a lot of patients have to take responsibility for their own health care. We have a different relationship with our primary care doctors than we used to. How much does this play into the story that we're trying to tell here?
Insofar as what's the responsibility of the patients to attract more of the doctors?
I think that what happens is that patients are expected to know a little bit more about their care. They're expected to track their care a little bit differently than they have in the past. How has that changed the relationships the patients are having with primary care doctors, or maybe changed the profession itself?
Well, my impression is that the doctors, the residents who really want to go into primary care value the fact that patients are more active about their care, and they really like those relationships, and they're not at all threatened by that. However, what I'm hearing is that those who, you know, prefer to kind of be the doctor who knows everything about a subject, maybe they're not the kind of doctor that would go into primary care. So I think what that does is it delineates who are those that are most likely to be happy in the field of primary care, but maybe that's not everybody.
Karen Brown's a reporter for New England Public Radio. Her documentary got us started thinking about this whole issue, and you can take a look at more information around it on our website, WNPR.org. Karen, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks also to Andrew Morris Singer, who's president and principal founder of Primary Care Progress. Thank you, Andrew.
Great being with you.
And thanks to Andy Selinger, who's the chair of family medicine at Quinnipiac University's new Frank Netter School of Medicine. We'll check back in with you, Andy, because I think there's a lot more to talk about. Thanks very much.
Glad to be here.
Our program produced by Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives, Betsy Kaplan and Kyle Wolf. Our digital editor is Heather Brandon. The executive producer of Where We Live is Katie Tolarski. This is Where We Live.